Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected.
He's the famous historical adventurer Dr. Sam Willis.
And he is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is Professor James Daybell. Now, Histories of the Unexpected is the show where we demonstrate how everything has a history, even the most unexpected of subjects, and how everything links together in unexpected ways.
Who knew, for example, who knew, Sam, that the history of tables is in fact all about equality, King Arthur, World War II, and spying. Everything's about spying. It's probably also about the Reformation. It is. It's in fact about the altar table.
Oh, yeah.
And all those difficulties.
I want to do the history tables. So one of the things we do is we do two things. One is to take unexpected subjects like mountains or courage and then explain how it does have a history. And the other thing we do is we take a well-known topic or subject and explain how you can approach that from an unexpected standpoint. So we are currently writing books with this in mind on the unexpected history of the Tudors, the unexpected history of Vikings, World War II, and then the Romans is coming up. Now, as it is October.
October? Is it October?
Things happen in October, James.
Oh, yes. Particularly on the 21st of October,
very good.
Sam.
So we thought we would try and apply our Histories of the Unexpected approach to the Battle of Trafalgar.
Goodness me. I know almost nothing about the Battle of Trafalgar. You've sprung this on me.
I have
in a moment.
Yeah. It's going to be good. It's going to be interesting.
Napoleonic Wars, Nelson. Yeah,
1805, Nelson, all those sort of things.
Ships.
This is the expected history. So I think I'm going to start by telling you what I think the expected history of Trafalgar is.
Oh, good. I will take notes.
Because often the point is, when you're trying to find out what is an unexpected approach, you need to do the opposite of it. Oh. Okay, so Trafalgar, we know a lot about Trafalgar. Historians really do know a great deal about it. We had the Bicentenary in 2005, and there was an enormous amount of work which was produced. We've had all sorts of fabulous biographies of Nelson. There are all sorts of fabulous biographies of Napoleon. There's histories of the French Navy and the Spanish Navy and the Royal Navy who all fought at Trafalgar. We've known the outline of what happened for years. So Napoleon was not trying to invade England. That's your starting point.
Okay.
He was sending his troops to Italy. He was sending his navy to Italy to reinforce some troop movements there. He'd given up on his idea to invade England. His ships, the combined French and Spanish fleet, were in Cadiz. They'd finally come there after being chased all around the world's oceans by Nelson. Then they get trapped into Cadiz and they are blockaded by a Royal Naval squadron. And then they come out. They come out to try and get to Italy and they are caught by the British. What happens next is, again, it is very well known. They are enormous battle fleets, much bigger compared to any of the other battles of the French Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars. There are some pretty big fleets in the...
How big is a big fleet at this time?
30 ships.
30 ships?
Yeah.
Gosh.
So each ship might have 700 people on board.
Gosh, so you're looking at thousands of sailors.
Thousands and thousands of sailors. The Battle of Ushant in the 1770s was enormous, but previously the ones that are really big are in the 1680s. It's a very big collision of naval power of different types. Different types of French naval power, Spanish naval power, British naval power. So, it's a very dominant performance by the Royal Navy, who utterly destroy the French and the Spanish. Then there's a storm, and all sorts of things happen afterwards. Okay, so my point here is that the narrative of the battle is well known. Nelson dies, it's a British victory. The outcome, the fallout of the battle is well known. And yet, I'm completely convinced that using an unexpected approach to it will bring benefits.
The casualties and losses are extraordinary for this. Yeah. Absolutely extraordinary. I mean, just looking at this, I'm a historian of the world, and you know, but I don't know, you know, had no idea of the high attrition rate here. I mean, if you think about it, you've got on the British side, you've got about 33 ships versus about 41 on the French and Spanish side. And the losses for the French and Spanish, 10 ships captured, one destroyed, over 2,200 dead, 1,100 or so wounded, 4,000 captures, 11 Spanish ships captured. A total of 13,500 people captured or killed.
And it's interesting that 3,000 of them are drowned in the storm after the battle.
Yeah, yeah.
So the thing that strikes me there, so we know the figures, often casualty figures in naval history are displayed as figures, but there's a whole process.
Ooh, yes.
So we know about medical history. We know how surgeons work. But what we don't know is we don't know about things like discomfort.
Well, and what's it like to drown? You know, of the 3,000 that are drowned in a storm,
how do
you capture that experience?
Exactly. How do you capture that experience, and how do you find it again? And it's one of those. It's one of the sort of examples of exercising the historical imagination to a certain extent, where you can get descriptions of people who have nearly drowned and who have survived. And there are a lot of them. I'm not sure there are any specific ones from Trafalgar. But the point is, with all of this pain and injury and wounding, yeah, we know about surgeon and we know about surgery in the 18th century. It's not our job to talk about it here.
That's your way in.
But we don't know about misery, discomfort,
wounds,
anxiety. Wounds to a certain extent we know about, but there are certain types of wounds we don't know about. So
maggots.
Yeah.
Gangrene.
Yeah.
Sores.
Yeah. All of those things are really
splinters.
Interesting.
Splinters.
And also, historians very much focused on the battle itself, and to a certain extent, the storm afterwards. But there's a fascinating history of the experience of being on a captured ship, which we don't know anything about. So you have a Royal Naval ship will send across a young lieutenant to take charge of a captured ship, and he's got maybe 1,000 shivering Frenchmen or Spaniards on board. But we don't know. Same with slave ships. We don't know. Almost nothing. Well, we know almost nothing about the experience of being on that ship, nor do we know the personal experience of the young person in charge. Because they would often write, you know, sent over to the Redoutable, to one of these French ships, to look after it. But he doesn't write, I'm terrified, I'm worried, I haven't done this before, I'm insecure about it. There's a whole kind of enormous range of human experience, which is lost to history or has yet been undiscovered.
Yeah. I mean, I also imagine there are different interpretations of Trafalgar that are more difficult to sort of get at. So Trafalgar meets gender. You know, how do you, you know, think about the history of the Navy from the perspective of women, you know, at a time when strictly women were not allowed on board ship. But we know that in various guises, women would get on ship, either as wives, prostitutes, women who are involved in provisioning.
Yeah.
So when you stop in at a port, you know, women are often the people who are going along taking the sort of fruit and vegetables along. Mm. What about the experience of the wives and families of sailors?
Yeah.
You know, left at home.
There's a very famous kind of visual idea of the woman standing back on the shoreline and waving as their sailor goes off to sea. But, you know, there's this kind of concern of anxiety, loss, expectation of news.
Yes.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, very, very. And I mean, yeah, one of the things, I'm going to take this to the Second World War at the moment. And one of the things with, one of the things that I'm looking at there is actually the history of handkerchiefs.
Yeah.
And handkerchiefs is all about escape. And one of the things that struck me was this idea that comes around in the, that is almost invented in the, in World War II, which is this escape-mindedness. So it's this kind of like positive attitude towards being captured and being away, because there's always, if you're escape-minded...
You have a professional responsibility
to escape.
You have
a professional responsibility to escape, which, viewed from the home front and the perspective of the wives, is not about, you know, concern and worry, but is a, it is about hope that these people are coming home. You know, transplant that into, you know... the Navy in, you know, the early 19th century. And what were the attitudes of, do we know what the wives and mothers and sisters and mothers felt about, you know, male family members going off to sea?
To a certain extent, we've got more letters written from sailors that have survived here.
Yes.
Because it's less wet,
yes.
principally, and it's
yes.
less dangerous than we have the other way around. But we know there was post. Post obviously took a long time to get to and fro.
And if you're reading an exchange like that, you can infer from a husband's letters that survive in the house, you can infer what the female members are saying.
The idea of escape's interesting. So on a couple of the captured ships, so the British capture the ships, but then the crews rise up and then they take the ship back. So there are a handful of ships which are retaken by the French and the Spanish after the battle on the way back to Cadiz. And I wonder if, you know, to what extent there was a professional responsibility to make life as awkward and difficult for your captors, as we read so much about in the Second World War. I suspect, as with most things in the 18th century Navy, it depended on every ship. It depended on the captain. There was no... The whole point about the period is why it's difficult to pin down, it's a bit like a jelly, is that there are different rules for different people, for different ships in different locations.
So we've gendered Trafalgar. Let's lob in a little... social class.
Yeah.
So how, you know, how one might one write a sort of working class history from below history of Trafalgar?
Well, we do have a lot of surviving letters from the lower deck.
Right, right.
And that's something that's been done.
Yeah. I've got some here.
Yeah, go on, have a look.
I've got some here from the National Maritime Museum.
Great.
There's a project... that is looking to do transcripts of letters of people from the lower deck, or Jack Tars, who were at Trafalgar. And letter from, here we are, Henry Blackburn, who was aged 21, an ordinary seaman from Ramsgate. And it's actually quite a good hand. I mean, the problem with a lot of people from the working classes or lower social orders at around this time is illiteracy. And so, you know, often written records don't survive, but there's an extraordinary number of these do. And he writes here, he's writing to his mother saying how he thanked God to spare him to see the 21st of October over. So he's obviously somebody who's survived. We were about the eighth ship in action about an hour after the Royal Sovereign fired the first shots. The ships was engaged were the French Berwick and the Spanish Augmont. So we've got a son writing to a mother. So immediately, you know, if we're not interested necessarily in this from the perspective of naval history and the battle, you've got a sort of thinking about the relationship between a mother and son. How does that letter get off the ship and get to his mother in Ramsgate?
Yeah.
How does the postal system work with those ships?
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating way of thinking about it, actually. Has he signed it?
Yeah, I think so.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus... Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Not so visible, but the history of the signature...
Ah, ha ha! I see where you're going with that.
...is interesting, particularly Nelson's signature. And we've done a podcast on the signature,
haven't we?
And Nelson's one of these famous people whose signature has changed. And his signature changed because he lost an arm in 1797, and he had it amputated, and then he was suddenly forced to learn to write. He said he'd lost his right arm. He's forced to write with his left arm. And one of the fabulous surviving... documents related to Nelson is the first letter he wrote with his left hand. And it's full of self-doubt and self-loathing. It's a really, really interesting thing. It really opens up Nelson's personality and his character. Now, his signature changes again when he becomes Baron Nelson of the Nile after the Battle of the Nile in 1798. And that means he can start signing things Nelson, not just Horatio Nelson. When you become Baron Nelson, you just sign it Nelson. But then it changes again because the King of Naples gives him an Italian dukedom. So he becomes the Duke of Bronte. So he gets this Sicilian dukedom, actually. Sicilian dukedom, the Duke of Bronte, which comes with a 12,000-acre estate at a 12th century abbey and a castle, which isn't bad for a parson's son from Norfolk. So he changes his name again. He becomes Nelson and Bronte. It's slightly kind of schizophrenic. But that's his signature that he uses right up until his death at the Battle of Trafalgar. And just before they go into battle, Nelson sits down. I think he has a certain sense of foreboding. He's completely convinced he's not going to survive. And he writes to his daughter, Horatia, who is the daughter he's had out of wedlock with Emma Hamilton, one of the great beauties of the age. And he basically admits to being her dad. But then, brilliantly, at the end of it, he doesn't sign it, "Lots of love, Dad." He signed Nelson and Bronte. Such a brilliantly Nelson thing. Just come on, admit it, you're a father. Be nice about it. So signatures are interesting, and I'm sure that a lot of people's signatures and handwriting would have changed in the immediate aftermath of Trafalgar through shock, because of wobbly handwriting.
Injury,
being unable to write. And then, you know, if that injury is permanent, it's good. Trafalgar will have survived and impacted on people's lives visible through their handwriting. Definitely. In French, Spanish, British accounts.
Take that idea of shock and trauma. Do we know much about post-traumatic stress from this period?
No, I don't think we do.
No. So there's another...
I apologise if there's a historian out there working on that
disability,
now.
Disability.
We know more about disability.
So we know about the sort of veterans who go off and...
And we wrote about that we talked about that in our podcast on The Lean, when we realised there was a history of people leaning over. Particularly in Greenwich. Because Greenwich was full of Royal Naval pensioners who might have lost a leg, the worst case scenario. So the physical appearance of people leaning, there was more of it going on in Greenwich related to Royal Naval history, which is important.
One of the other interesting things is that a battle like this is memorialised.
Yes.
You know, I mean, we're doing it now because it is the anniversary of this event, but it's memorialised in statues, in squares. You know, we've had two centenaries of it, 100 years, 200 years. Yeah. You know, and what does that suggest about the importance of an event, a big national event, in the sort of nation psyche?
Yeah, and some of the really significant things like Trafalgar Square, that doesn't even happen around a centenary or a bicentenary. There's massive things going on all the way through, and when you go to a Trafalgar night dinner, I'm going to one in a couple of days' time. You toast the immortal memory of Nelson. Okay, I don't know of another historical character that you stand up and toast their immortal memory of. And it's a weird phrase, but it's one of the reasons that Trafalgar is not forgotten. because there's a kind of onus on it for us not to forget it, a conscious onus. You toast the immortal memory, you will not let it forget it. I mean, the whole point about history is that you might learn lessons, you might do all of this stuff, you might have pioneers doing new things, but you might often forget about it as well. It's the nature of archives, it's the nature of history. Someone can do something amazing, completely new, and then we can forget about it within 100 years, within 20 years.
Mm-hmm. But it's that, I'm sure there are characters, I can't think off the top of my head, but I'm sure there would be characters that you would...
You toast their memory, but I'm not sure it's the phrase, the immortal memory.
Yeah.
Who decided it was going to be mortal? I'd love to know the history of that toast. History of toast is interesting.
Yes. Of toasts and toast.
Toast and toasting?
Yes.
Drinking?
Yes. Yeah. We should do toasting.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But it's all to do with maintaining memory, isn't it?
Yes.
That's an
unexpected history of Trafalgar.
It is. I'm just looking at this very famous painting called by Daniel MacLeish called The Death of Nelson.
Oh, let me find
it. And it's a huge jumble of people on board Victory just at the moment that Nelson's been shot. And it's fabulous in that it gives you a window into a naval world.
It's an enormously long, very busy picture.
So this, we've got a huge jumble of people here, sort of all crowded around Nelson on the decks of HMS Victory.
Masts broken, smoke.
Yeah, smoke's an interesting cannons. One. You could do the history of smoke.
Yeah.
Because that's also to do with the history of visibility.
Tatters. Bodies.
Tatters is good.
Tatters. Splinters.
And the body language of it important. Pockets. Pockets and handbags.
Ropes.
We did our pocket.
Balconies.
We did a pocket one very similar to this, didn't we? Talking about the way that people are posed with their hands in pockets in a Victorian painting of a number of people on a race day. Here it is very similar. And I would love... Someone said to me, okay, how would you like to understand the Battle of Trafalgar? I'd like to get all of the sailors together just before the Battle of Trafalgar and get them to empty their pockets.
Ooh,
how fantastic would
brilliant.
That be? What were you keeping in your pocket and why? We've got some women helping here. But again, we've talked about the gender and social history. And to a certain extent, that's understood. Hair
a
is interesting.
A small boy carrying...
Yeah. So you've got there were children on board the ships. This is a powder monkey. He's gone down to the magazine to collect a cartridge for the cannon. He's walking around quickly. Notice he has no shoes on. History of shoes.
We should so... I so want to do shoes.
Yeah. So some of the soldiers are wearing boots. The kids are not wearing shoes. There's a sailor here not wearing shoes. It looks to me like the sailors... are not wearing shoes and the soldiers are wearing shoes.
Presumably because his feet grew. You know, young kids' feet grow. Shoes are expensive and you just go through shoes.
There was always some argument that it was something to do with climbing and the rigging as well, but I've always doubted that.
I bet.
It would just be more comfortable and more safe
if you're
wearing shoes. If you've got some leather protecting the sole of your foot. Because one of the things that these guys can't do is to risk getting injured. Because if they get injured, then someone else has got to take their position. That makes it more like you've got to run through more crew, you need more people. And shoes is a very kind of an obvious example. Like, just put your shoes on. Otherwise, you're going to drop cannonballs on your feet and hurt yourself up in the rigging.
We've done hands, but what about, what about arms? The history of arms.
Arms is interesting, particularly with Nelson having lost
chests, hearts. We haven't done hearts.
Hearts would be good, but you're saying chests because there are a lot of... men
clutching their chests.
Clutching their chests, stripped to the waist here.
Yeah.
Sort of protecting the vulnerable areas of their chests. And that must also be the sound. I mean, this is silent. This is a silent painting. But what's going on here? The glances and the looking is really interesting. Why are you looking in some places? Why are you not looking in others? Deafness.
Disaster. The history of disaster.
Yeah, and how you cope with it.
Yeah.
But that's also to do with shock, post-traumatic stress. The deafness is an interesting one, where you some people would have been stone deaf anyway because of all the cannon. It might have been the majority of these people were stone deaf. Did they have sign language?
Yeah.
I don't know. I know it wasn't invented by then. I know there wasn't sign language until much, much later, proper sign language until much, much later on. So how did the proper deaf people on board these ships, of which there would have been a lot, how did they communicate? And also, how did they experience the battle? Because they'd have experienced it in a different way, because they're not hearing the bangs, they're feeling them. It's a physical thing. They'd have felt it as vibrations.
What about the emotional history of Trafalgar? You know, we've got a whole range of emotions here, from grief, horror, terror. Nobody smiling. This is not, you know, in no way an ecstatic state, but, you know, grief, anger.
That's true, but you know, we are in a crisis point of battle here.
Yep.
And the thing about the Navy is that they spent 2% of their time actually fighting.
Yep.
And the majority of the time they would have been interacting and engaging with each other in the way that humans do. And that would have involved laughter
and
it would have chat
and
and the noise.
So life on board ship.
And it's, you know, it is sort of frustrating as a naval historian that there's so much focus put on Trafalgar in 1805, this particular moment. And yes, you can look at the battles, but it's the day-to-day life that is lost.
Yeah.
When you see these, and a lot of these people will write letters about it. They'll get home, they'll survive. They might write to someone and say, look, I've managed to survive this. They might write to their mate. They might write to their mother, their parents or their wives or children. And so this moment then becomes a moment frozen in time. But what about everything else? That's when it's, you know, you can, to a certain extent, find it through logbooks, but you only get a sense of the sort of day-to-day boringness of life. But if you look at a picture like this, you've got so many people.
Yep.
And the thing about people like this is they all interpret things differently.
Yep. I mean, just look at the objects here as well. Jugs, there's a slate, there's a hat. I mean, you could do all manner of things with that. A sword, weapons, rings, belts. I want to do the history of the belt.
Yeah, me too. That's a tremendous one. So you've got a variety of belts here. So you've got the soldiers with their white kind of across the chest. It was like I don't even know what it's called, but it reminds me of a Sam Brown belt, which is a Second World War one, where you have your waist belt and then one going across the chest. You've got a lot of it would be handmade leather work, and it would have been customised for each sailor, who would have been able to scratch their initials on it. Graffiti would have been so important. Right. Scratch their initials, and then you're using the marlin spike, you're using the knife, or whatever it is, to graffiti, you know, bits of wood, whittle away.
Yeah. Graffiti left on ships of this age?
There is, but what I don't know about it is whether they got in trouble doing it. I bet they did. I bet you weren't allowed officially to do it. So I suspect it's probably up in the nooks and crannies where you don't know.
I was going to say you'd probably do it in places where it wasn't going to be seen. Yeah. Gosh, who knew that the Battle of Trafalgar was all these things?
That was massively enjoyable. I tell you what, get in touch with us if you've got any genius ideas about the way we could think about the Battle of Trafalgar in a new and exciting and unexpected way. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Me too.
If you've enjoyed listening to us, then please check us out online at historiesoftheunexpected.com. You can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Instagram and Flickr and YouTube. You can come see us live if we're doing a show near you, and you can read our books. We're massively proud of our books. It was enormous fun writing it, and we'd love you to read a copy.
Histories of the Unexpected, How Everything Has a History. It's out with Atlantic Books, those lovely people who are just brilliant. It's out now.
That's it. Thank you very much, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.